From Hawaii to Pennsylvania, Georgia to Utah, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, illegal immigration is back in the headlines as the separation of families at the Mexican border exploded in controversy. Dr. Matthew Spaulding of Hillsdale College is here to sort through U.S. policy. And once folks come over the border seeking asylum or arrive as a refugee from another nation, they need resettlement assistance. Providing that help is the mission of World Relief. We talk with Matthew Sorens to learn more about their ministry. The Supreme Court of the United States issued rulings in congressional redistricting cases this past week, but they did little to clarify the situation. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine reports. And tariffs are usually bad, but not always. Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA brings some common sense to the tariff discussion on this week's American Radio Journal Commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Despite the fact it has been going on for years, this past week, U.S. policy of separating children from parents illegally entering the country exploded as a major issue. Here to explain how the policy came about and what changes should be considered is Dr. Matthew Spaulding. Matt is Associate Vice President and Dean of Education at Hillsdale College's Washington, D.C. campus. Matt, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Matt, this whole issue of children being separated from parents at the border as parents are crossing the border illegally, there's been a lot of information, a lot of misinformation. What exactly is the law and what policies govern this process?
This is a microcosm, if you will, of a much larger problem we have with our immigration policies, which is to say they're very complicated, they're very messy, based on decades of, in some cases, poorly written laws, in which the laws passed by Congress have given a lot of discretion to executives, to presidents. And in this particular case, you now have positions and policies of presidencies going back, the Clinton, Bush, Obama, and now Trump, which have all been very different. And you've had a couple of instances where courts have become involved. And the complications of all those things in combination have created this particular situation. In particular, I'll mention a couple of things. First of all, going back to 1997, there was a court intervention, and they created a settlement, which the Clinton administration agreed to. When someone is arrested, this is in general, a parent and they have children, the parent and the children are separated. If you're arrested domestically and you're sent to jail, they don't put your children in jail with you. Same is true with questions of individuals here illegally from foreign countries. They come here. If they're in the country already, which is to say they're here illegally, they get arrested or stopped for some reason with children. The law actually requires that they be separated from those children. There was a court settlement in 1997 that said those children had to be held as briefly as possible and as safely as possible, which meant that the adult who was held in custody by the immigration services would be separated from the child who would go to be held under Health and Human Services, a completely different operation because law enforcement can't actually hold children. Jump ahead. This policy was a little bit of a problem under the Bush administration because it caused the types of things that are happening now, but at much lower numbers. They continued under the Obama administration. But the Obama administration had a further policy, well, that if this situation happens, we're going to do something which became known as catch and release. That would solve the problem of separating parents and children. This becomes an additional problem, especially when it's usually very brief. It very quickly gets settled in a matter of hours, perhaps even just a day or so. But in cases of asylum claims, where this is especially problematic, this becomes a real problem. And now you have a Trump administration who has instituted a policy that they're going to have a zero-tolerance policy. We're going to take in and arrest and try to stop anybody who's here legally. Look, numbers have grown. Now you've actually got a much larger problem where more numbers of children are separated from the parents with the asylum problem potentially for longer periods of time. hence a microcosm of a larger immigration crisis, really, we have in the country writ large.
So this is not a new policy. What we're really talking about here is the degree to which the policy is being enforced by the Trump administration. So as you mentioned, asylum. Explain for our listeners what we mean by the term asylum and why has that aggravated the problem and created a special set of circumstances?
The United States has a quite liberal, I think rightly so, liberal policy about asylum. People come from other countries seeking asylum because of political persecution, religious persecution, violent gangs, threats to themselves. They come here, they ask for asylum. The United States considers the case and either accepts it or rejects it according to how that policy decision is made. There are two factors here that have made it more complicated. One is our rules of asylum themselves are quite broad and actually have gotten broader over the last number of years. And there's been a move going back to previous administrations for asylum reform. Let's try to get more specific here. Let's try to narrow it down. And when it's really broad, that creates an incentive for people who are coming here not for true asylum reasons, but for other reasons, to use it as a ploy, if you will, as a way of trying to hide. They come here, they're caught, and they claim asylum. That keeps them in the country. So you have that problem. The other problem you have is that asylum, the way it's supposed to work, is that when an individual comes to the United States, let's say they come up from Central America or someplace else, they should go to a port of entry, a place where they can legally go, talk to an officer in the United States, and say, I'm here seeking asylum. That's the way it's supposed to work. But increasingly, these are individuals who have already entered the country. They're here illegally. They've been stopped for some other reason, and now they're claiming asylum. So it becomes more and more complicated. And a third factor I would put in there is that the demographics of these individuals have changed. In the past, most of the immigrants who were here illegally, the numbers were being driven by single males. Increasingly, those numbers are being driven by women with children or families, which, of course, then makes this child separation of children problem even more complicated. But you're right to go to the point that the hardest part here, the thing that's really driving this, is this asylum problem.
We have been talking with Matthew Spaulding. Matt is Associate Vice President and Dean of Educational Programming at Hillsdale College's Washington, D.C. campus. And Matt, tell us a bit about Hillsdale. Where can folks go also to read more about this issue?
Hillsdale is an old college based in Michigan. We have a facility, a campus here in Washington, D.C. called the Kirby Center, where we do work on Congress especially and other major public policy questions from the background of a larger, more academic point of view. You can find out information about us, including take our online courses at hillsdale.edu, and there's lots of information there. Anybody interested in these and other questions?
Matt Spaulding of Hillsdale College. Matt, thank you for being with us.
Great being with you.
We continue our discussion of the immigration issue now with Matthew Sorens. He is U.S. Director of Church Mobilization with World Relief. Matthew, we've just talked a little bit about what asylum means and the fact that that is a term that is vague and contributing to this overall problem. In terms of refugees, how would you define a refugee and how do you determine whether or not somebody's coming into the United States illegally because they just want to get a better job, or maybe they're coming in here for nefarious reasons, as opposed to somebody who truly maybe has been religiously or otherwise persecuted?
The legal definition of a refugee under U.S. law, and this is in the Refugee Act of 1980, is that it's a person who has fled their country of origin because of a well-founded fear of persecution on account of their race, religion, political opinion, national origin, or social group. So it's a pretty precise definition. It doesn't include people who are fleeing poverty. As sympathetic as that may be, it doesn't qualify you as a refugee under U.S. law. Or if you're fleeing a natural disaster, that doesn't make you a refugee. Best estimates are there's somewhere around 25 million refugees in the world, and the U.S. receives refugees in two different ways. One is through a refugee resettlement program. That's something that World Relief has been a part of since the late 70s, where officers of the U.S. government, of the Department of Homeland Security, operating in collaboration with the Department of State, vet people overseas, screen them, determine by in-person interviews that they meet that legal definition of a refugee, and also that they're in no way someone we don't want in the United States. They do a pretty thorough background check. It usually takes somewhere between 18 months and 3 years to vet someone, and then they're invited to come to the United States. That's a very small part of the world's refugees who get that opportunity. Of about 25 million in the world, this year it'll be probably 22,000 who are able to come to the U.S., so less than 0.1%. But then the other dynamic is there's people who aren't selected abroad as refugees, but make their own way to the United States, whether arriving at the border without any visa or with a tourist visa but wanting to stay permanently, or at an airport with some sort of a temporary visa. And they can then claim asylum under law, basically claiming that they meet that definition of a refugee, someone who has a well-founded fear of persecution for one of those five reasons enumerated under the law.
As we look at the problem that has really exploded onto the scene this past week, where we have individuals who are coming over the southern border of the United States and they're bringing small children with them. Of course, nobody wants to see families separated, and the president has issued an executive order to bring a temporary halt to that. But Matthew, even though the president's issued an executive order, is that something you think is going to stand? Because it does run contrary to not only laws passed by Congress and signed into law by a previous president, but also court orders that strengthen that. So is the president's action really going to even stand?
That's the question of the hour. And I would say, first of all, I'm grateful for the president's acknowledging that a lot of American people have been very troubled by the idea of taking small children away from their parents. What it now says will happen is instead of separating families, we'll detain them together. The problem, as you alluded to, is there is existing there's a consent decree from a court, and it also has tied to the Trafficking Victims Protection Reauthorization Act, a law passed under President Bush, that effectively says you can't detain children for an unlimited amount of time. It actually specifies you can detain them for no more than 20 days, and that means that we can't detain families together with children for more than 20 days. Now, the executive order basically said the judge should change that, or Congress should change that. But Congress has a hard time changing things sometimes. It's a complicated process that they've not proven that they can find the consensus to do. And it's very possible the judge will not change that. In fact, the Obama administration wanted the judge to change that, and she was unwilling. And, I mean, she would argue, she's coming from the perspective that I think a lot of Americans, and I personally would agree with, that fundamentally children don't belong in jail or in jail-like detention facilities. And if there's not a reason to think that someone is a threat to public safety, we can keep them, allow them to be taken care of outside, let church groups here in El Paso, where I'm at today, there's a number of local churches that are really used to helping care for asylum seekers. And even if there's a concern they won't show up for court, you can put on an ankle bracelet with a GPS tracker that is literally pennies on the dollar in terms of cost to the taxpayer. And if they don't show up for court, then you can come find them and detain them. But that has proven very effective to make sure people show up for court. So if the purpose is to make sure people come to their hearing, I think that's a great solution. If the purpose is to be a deterrent for people to request asylum, which some people in the administration have said it is, others have said it is not, well, then putting people into a jail-like detention facility could potentially be a deterrent, but it really depends what you're fleeing. If you're really fleeing a threat of, you know, someone saying, I'm going to kill your child, you'll probably come even at the risk of being separated from them.
So what is the role, Matthew, of churches, of the religious community in this, keeping this separate and apart from all the legalities and all the policy issues? What role can Christians play, and any other religion for that matter?
There's lots of different faith groups working on this. We do work, you know, we're a Christian organization, so we work primarily with churches. People have a lot of questions on the government's role, and that's appropriate. I want to make sure, as a Christian, that we're not missing out on the church's role, which to me is actually a simpler question. It's to love your neighbor as yourself. It's to practice hospitality, which is a biblical command, and literally in the Greek of the New Testament, hospitality is philoxenia, or the love of strangers. So we do that in really practical ways at World Relief. We are part of that refugee resettlement program. We work with local churches to meet people at the airport when they arrive, and again, with that process, they have full legal status from the moment they arrive. It's all very straightforward in that sense. But it's not straightforward in the sense that it's adjusting to a new culture in a completely different country, having gone through a lot of trauma. So it's so vital that these people have friends when they arrive, and the church can do that. We call it a good neighbor team, who will be a small group from a local church who will welcome folks. And on the same level, we work with churches to do legal services around the country. Probably not with a church to do like an asylum case, because those are very specific and intensive, but we do naturalization workshops with local churches, where a church will open up their doors on a Saturday. We will train volunteers to understand the naturalization application, and then our legal staff will screen people, make sure that they have had their green card for the requisite amount of time, that they qualify, that they don't have criminal issues that would disqualify them. And then the volunteers can help fill out those applications. And it's a very extensive application. I think it's 16 or 17 pages at this point. There's lots of ways that we do that at World Relief, of empowering local churches to come alongside those who are vulnerable. And then we speak into the policy questions as well, because those affect people. But our core work is really on the ground ministering to people.
We have been talking with Matthew Sorens, who is the United States Director of Church Mobilization with World Relief. Matthew, where can folks go on the web to learn more about your organization?
Yeah, if people go to worldrelief.org, you can find out what we do in the United States and overseas with refugees and other vulnerable people as well.
Matthew Sorens of World Relief. Matthew, thank you so much for taking time to be with us.
Thank you for having me.
Challenges to the congressional district maps in several states have ended up before the Supreme Court. The court issued opinions this past week, but that resulted in bringing little clarity to the process. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine explains.
Well, the U.S. Supreme Court issued two much-anticipated rulings on redistricting this week, but they actually just decided not to decide much of anything. In both cases, they kicked the matter back to lower courts and gave reasons why they couldn't issue a sweeping decision now. But the question of redistricting or gerrymandering is going to come back before the high court, and probably sooner rather than later. And there are some clues in this week's two decisions, or non-decisions, that give us an indication of where the court might be heading on this very important issue ahead of the next set of redistricting, which will take place after the 2020 census. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. No guest for me this week. Instead, we're taking a look at these two decisions out of the U.S. Supreme Court this week, the one a challenge from Wisconsin and the other a challenge from Maryland, looking at redistricting and gerrymandering, which is, if you don't know, the process of carving partisan districts that favor one political party or one candidate over another. There's really sort of two basic ways you can do that. You can either pack voters of one party into a district and draw lines to exclude voters of a different party, or you can crack areas that have a large concentration of voters, say a large concentration of Democrats in a city, could be cracked, divided between a number of different districts so as to dilute their overall electoral power. Now, in deciding not to decide on these two major redistricting cases, the U.S. Supreme Court this week signals that it's not going to wade into the fight over partisan gerrymandering for now, but the justices did leave the door open to revisiting this issue and probably pretty soon. The high court released these two challenges, as I said, one out of Wisconsin and one from Maryland. In Wisconsin, it was a group of Democrats challenging what they said was a Republican-drawn map that unfairly disenfranchised them. And in Maryland, it was exactly the opposite, a group of Republicans saying that a Democrat-drawn map was illegal and a partisan gerrymander. In the Maryland case, the court merely issued a per curiam order. That's an unsigned order. None of the justices put their name on it. They just sent it back to a lower court to be reconsidered. But the Wisconsin case is the more interesting one here. The case is technically known as Gill v. Whitford. And in this one, the court ruled unanimously that the plaintiffs lacked appropriate standing. Now, despite the lack of a substantive ruling, Chief Justice John Roberts took the opportunity to author this unanimous opinion outlining kind of where the court stands on this question of gerrymandering. And Roberts' opinion makes it very clear that a successful challenge to partisan redistricting must rest on the disenfranchisement of individual voters rather than on the claim that one political party has been harmed. And this is important. He writes in the decision that this is a case about group political interests, not individual legal rights. And he adds that this court is not responsible for vindicating generalized partisan preferences. Now, the Wisconsin case included four plaintiffs who had argued that their votes had been unfairly diluted by the manipulation of district boundaries by the Republican-drawn state legislature, the Republican state legislature that had drawn those districts. One of the plaintiffs, William Whitford, was a retired law professor at the University of Wisconsin, and he admitted that the Republican map didn't change the outcome of the elections in his own district at all. Because he lives in Madison, after all. It's about as blue of a place as you can find in the Midwest. And so, regardless of how other districts might have been changed, Whitford's district was as solidly blue as it ever could have been. Instead, he claimed, somewhat ridiculously, that he suffered a harm that extended beyond his own vote and his own legislative districts. He told a district court that the only practical way to accomplish my policy objectives is to get a majority of Democrats in the Assembly and the Senate, ideally in order to get the legislative product that I prefer. Now, this makes it sound like the entire redistricting case was actually just a scheme to elect Democrats. And, well, you're not entirely wrong if that's the way you see it. This had always been a weakness of the Wisconsin challenge, and the plaintiffs knew it going into the Supreme Court. And again, remember, Roberts made it very clear that the Supreme Court will not wade into these issues simply to give one party an advantage over the other, or to cancel out an advantage that has been gained through redistricting. The court is only interested in whether individual people have had their votes somehow discounted because of redistricting. That the Supreme Court unanimously backed this anti-partisan view is certainly a welcome sign. That unanimity, though, tells only about half the story. While all nine justices agreed that the Wisconsin plaintiffs did not have standing for a broad challenge, the four liberal justices on the court signed on to a concurring opinion by Justice Elena Kagan that likely foreshadows the next round of redistricting challenges. Once there is sufficient standing established, Kagan argues, then statewide evidence and a statewide remedy could be on the table, she says. So when gerrymandering inevitably comes back to the Supreme Court, that is going to be where the battle lines are drawn, and it's going to be the justices in the middle of the left-right divide, probably Justice Anthony Kennedy, who will be the ones to watch. But in the meantime, a better solution to America's gerrymandering crisis would be for state legislatures to impose upon themselves, or to impose upon state redistricting commissions where those are used, some sort of limitation for how much partisan map-making is tolerable. It's probably right to be skeptical of the idea that state lawmakers and political parties will voluntarily give up their ability to influence the redistricting process, but it would certainly be preferable to see these sorts of solutions come from individual states rather than be imposed from the court on the way down. Courts really shouldn't be involved in giving partisan advantage to one team or the other, and Roberts makes this point repeatedly, pointing to the fact that none of the plaintiffs in the case could prove they were directly harmed in the Wisconsin redistricting plan. And I think we can all agree that when it comes to partisan gerrymandering, Chief Justice John Roberts is right when he says that this is about collective political interest, not individual legal interests. And the court, the Supreme Court, must be cautious that it does not become a forum for generalized grievances. This isn't the end of the fight over redistricting in the U.S. Supreme Court, but at least Chief Justice John Roberts seems to be guiding the court in a direction that suggests whatever solution or whatever outcome we do end up with will be one that is based on individual rights rather than based on the collective preferences of either liberals or conservatives. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm.
President Trump has continued placing tariffs on a number of foreign goods, prompting both criticism and praise. Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA sorts through the rhetoric on this American Radio Journal commentary.
There has been so much demagoguery and emotionally charged rhetoric on trade and tariffs in the last few weeks that it has fueled talk of a global trade war and rattled world stock markets. Our friends in the media, most of whom know little about business or economics, are only too happy to amplify the hysteria because they delight in doing anything to further their image of President Trump as a petulant, narcissistic ignoramus who deserves no benefit of any doubt. They parrot every economist who supports global trade as a kind of holy grail, a container of almost divine truths. So let's try another tack, common sense, or maybe just sense, since it doesn't seem to be very common these days. Truly free trade among all countries would be the most effective way to lower prices for all goods. Whatever country or countries could produce certain goods at the lowest price should be rewarded with the most sales, if all other factors such as quality were equal. That's primarily because the cost of labor is a major factor in the cost of most goods. Countries with low labor costs can produce goods at low prices. Products that involve a lot of labor will benefit the most from this cost-lowering effect. Apparel and electronics are two categories of goods that especially benefit from this dynamic. Lightweight, labor-intensive goods can be shipped at low cost. When is the last time you saw Made in the USA on a shirt, a pair of shoes, or a mobile phone? Low costs help all buyers afford more and better goods, so these lower costs are considered solid evidence of the economic benefits of free trade. Now, if you were a shoemaker, you might not be quite as ready to tout the economic benefits of lower-cost shoes made in Vietnam. The shoemaking industry in New England has been virtually wiped out by low-cost foreign-made shoes. Shoemakers are told that they should be trained to do something else in the new economy, and that is indeed a better response than imposing a tariff, which is simply a tax on imported goods. Tariffs protect domestic industries by raising the prices of competing foreign goods. Tariffs protect domestic labor by protecting the domestic industries that employ that labor. So politicians supported by organized labor often support protective tariffs. In most cases, those are Democratic Party members because they typically benefit from the vast political spending of unions. Republicans typically support eliminating as many protective tariffs as possible to promote economic prosperity through lower-cost goods. The fact that eliminating tariffs also weakens unions is a kind of political bonus. Tariffs are generally bad because they are economically inefficient. Here is a message printed on a T-shirt held up by Senator Orrin Hatch as printed in the Cato Policy Report. Tariffs not only impose immense economic costs, but also fail to achieve their primary policy aims and foster political dysfunction along the way. I'm not sure how many T-shirts with that snappy legend Cato sold, but my guess is not many. But nonetheless, the statement itself does spell out the free trade gospel in succinct terms. The website debate.org features this statement on their "Tariffs are bad, bad, bad" side of the debate. Quote, "Tariffs destroy the ability of the international market system to allocate resources efficiently. This is obviously bad. When a tariff is enacted, it raises prices on imports, which lowers domestic demand for imported goods. This then reduces the income of the exporting countries, which in turn causes them to demand less of foreign exports." Close quote. However, the free trade advocates seldom admit that there are circumstances where paying the price of economic inefficiency is exactly the right thing to do if they protect a domestic industry that is strategically vital for the home country. Steel is one such industry. Aircraft manufacturing is another. The United States cannot become dependent on other nations for these vital goods. The number of truly strategic, vital industries is small. But when President Trump threatens or imposes tariffs on steel and aluminum, he's not as empirically wrong as free traders would have you believe. And he's not the ignoramus that the media covering him would have you believe. Tariffs are bad most of the time, but when they protect strategically vital industries, the economic inefficiency they induce is a price worth paying. This has been Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring for American Radio Journal. Visit us on the web at letfreedomringusa.com.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WHTY-AM in West Palm Beach, Florida, WYLF-AM in Penyan, New York, along with WWOS-FM in Orangeburg, South Carolina. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.